Welcome to Facilitating the Mission, the podcast of Shepherd Staff Mission Facilitators. My name is Brian Mondock.
And my name is Jeff Jackson. What's going on, man?
It's so good to talk to you.
You too.
I'm very excited about this orality series. Everywhere I am looking these days, people are talking about it. It's as if somehow someone's been reading our emails.
That must be what it is. Or we're just part of this. We're finally catching on to what's already been taking place for a long time. And I think that's probably more of what it is.
Well, we've got Tripp Kimball on the line with us. Jeff, why don't you tell us who Tripp Kimball is?
Well, first of all, hey, Tripp, how you doing, man?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. For those of you that are listening, Tripp is an old friend of mine. Actually, we're both kind of older now, but we met actually in the Philippines when I was serving on the island of Cebu, and he was on the next island over on the island of Negros, but he was in the city of Dumaguete. And we connected over there and actually did some travel teaching IBS workshops. And the relationship that began over there has continued these many years. And we've been involved with what God's doing around the world at different levels. And Tripp is an amazing man of God with an incredible track record. And so I think it'd be a good idea, Tripp, why don't you just sort of give us some of your backstory so we have some foundation for what you're going to talk about.
Basically, I'd say I'm a refugee from the Jesus movement of the late 60s, early 70s. Just came through all of that, ended up being a church planter in 78 up in the high desert of Southern California. Got to a point where I think my heart was just being pulled to do more training of pastors and leaders. I saw a need for that overseas, and I wanted to be involved more on that discipleship leadership role, which has always been kind of natural for me, I guess. So I joined a ministry called Intensive Care Ministries and went over there I spent about a year and a half getting the church ready to transition, transitioned it in January of 90 and moved with my family over to Dumaguete City, Philippines in the end of June of 1990. And so I was the rookie pastor, even though I'd had experience as a church planner. I was the rookie missionary. And I was over there to teach pastors and leaders inductive Bible study, which I did for many years and still do to a certain degree. And my wife or my family and I should say, we went through about a month of pre-field training down in Tijuana with Neil Perolo and MAS Road International, which was great. After that, the Philippines, transitioning to the Philippines was pretty easy as far as cultural stuff. And then the other thing I did was I went through some training with Dan Finfrock with Inductive Bible Study. And that's the guy, missionary I joined. And I'm going to kind of mention something about that, something that happened during that time that really was part of all that came into play as far as me becoming more involved with orality and biblical storying.
Tripp, we just want to give a plug to what you're currently doing as well before we jump into today's discussion about orality. Could you do that real quick?
Sure. In 2005, we came back to the U.S., not to California, but to Florida, which is where we live now. Take care of my dad. We're still taking care of my mom and in the process of taking care of Susan's mom here pretty soon. And I started getting involved about 10 years ago, maybe 9 years ago, with a veteran pastor, Bill Holdridge, and a couple of other guys with Poimen Ministries, P-O-I. M-E-N, which is a Greek word for shepherd. And so we're veteran pastors who work with pastors and churches. Our little vision statement is we strengthen pastors to strengthen churches. We do a lot of things with assessments. We also do transitions, pastoral transitions, pastoral coaching or mentoring. And then I still have my hand in doing some short-term missions training and that sort of thing as well with the local church.
Well, that's very cool, Tripp. And we'll make sure we put a link to the website in these show notes today.
Okay, great.
Great. So, Tripp, how did orality come on your ministry and radar screen? Can you kind of give us that story?
Sure. Pretty much the way most everything I've learned happens, and that is I stumbled into it. It wasn't like I set out to learn it. It really came about, and that's probably one of the key things that happened in terms of the inductive Bible study training was that one of the elements of the training was to help people get involved in the story. Mm-hmm. Not a dramatizing of it, but just walking them through the story so that they can kind of see it in their imagination. So that stuck with me because I really liked that idea. And I love reading stories anyway. So I'm, you know, connected to all that stuff. Another thing that happened is I was working with training pastors in these inductive Bible study or IBS workshops. I noticed that they would get confused because we're working off of English materials, but we also had some in the dialect as well. But they would get confused as we laid out all these different guidelines for them to study. You know, I didn't really quite understand at first what was happening. I just saw that they were getting confused when they went to go do the assignments. Then we began to do more translating of our materials into different dialects. There's, you know, there's, as you know, Jeff, there's well over 70 different dialects in the Philippines. Yes. Mm-hmm. And so we tried to work with the major dialects because our goal was to train national pastors, leaders to be our teachers instead of it always being, you know, an expat or American leading the workshops. We realized that there were problems with our translations that we were getting, that we were having done. So I went to an Wycliffe SIL translators workshop for about a month down in Mindanao. It was mind-blowing. I mean, I was like really, really impressed with the work translators do. And it began to give me some insight as to how they did that. They, you know, they do a translation, then they do what they call a back translation back into English. And then they edit it and they just keep going kind of back and forth, back and forth. And so it just made a lot of sense to me. Mm-hmm. I kind of incorporated that into what we were doing in terms of how we were teaching and training pastors and leaders. And then the other thing that happened was my kids were in school, just like yours were. And my youngest daughter says, you know, Dad, I don't really understand this thing in math. And I says, well, ask your teacher. She says, oh, no, Dad, I can't ask him. I said, what do you mean you can't ask him? He says, because it will offend him if I ask the teacher. Mm-hmm. I really didn't get it at first. And then I began to have a little more understanding as I did workshops that the kind of the standard approach to education in most of what I call most of the rest of the world, MOTRO, is it's just rote memorization, you know, information in, information out. Or as I call it, you know, information, you take it in, you eat it, and then you regurgitate it on a piece of paper or in a test or orally, or, you know, like in an exam or whatever. And so it really started my mind thinking about it. There's got to be a better way to help people understand inductive Bible study because it's so linear and analytical in its approach. Mm-hmm. All of those things were factors in preparing me. And then I was asked to start a Bible college. And I didn't want to do it because they were going to use audio and video tapes. And I said, well, now I just refused to do that. And he said, well, you can do it however you want to do it. So I was given this kind of carte blanche thing. And then it was kind of like, okay, so now what do I do? And so I developed a very interactive process, inductive Bible study process. And then I developed some what I call study questions to circumvent the tendency to just copy things out of a commentary or a study Bible or whatever. And then I developed what I call IYOW, in your own words, where I would get the students to learn how to take things and define them, but in their own words. In other words, they had to keep putting things in their own words. And so all of that started happening. Plus, I'm a very interactive person, and my natural form is discipleship, mentoring. And through all of that, I just began to learn more and more what works and what didn't work. And then I realized that the gospel just it just wasn't understood. I began to really go back and retool how I present the gospel. And in doing that, I began to focus more on the story of itself and, you know, bits and parts of the story. I don't mean bits and parts in the sense of a verse or two. I mean, looking at the various parts of the story itself. I don't know if that helps.
Tripp, when you were in this process, did you come to some conclusions about sort of the way especially Filipinos learned? I mean, obviously you mentioned the rote learning method used in schools and so forth.
Right.
Were you sort of also learning about maybe the reality that they were better audio learners than visual learners, or where did that come in the process?
Well, yeah, that is a great question. So one day I was preaching in a church, mm-hmm. and I, you know, of course I'd laid out my outline and everything. And then I inserted this story about a farmer and his son and a carabao. It was kind of a favorite parable among Filipinos.
Yes.
You remember that story?
I do, actually. I do, but go ahead.
So as I got into telling that story, it was like everybody stopped looking at their watch, their Bible, talking to their neighbor. And I literally had everybody's attention. And it was just one of those moments where you realize, okay, so story engages them. And so, it was just one of those things, I guess they called a tipping point. It was just all these different things started cascading and pushing me towards really looking at how effective storytelling is in terms of biblical instruction. And so I would do that even in the classroom without really knowing that's what I was doing, if that makes sense.
Good. So while you were doing this then, I mean, were you continuing sort of building on what you learned from the SIL folks at that workshop and stuff you went to?
I think one of the significant things was the learning how to take your translation, being willing to have somebody else take it and back translate it into English. In other words, you translate it, let's say we'll just use Spanish. You translate it into a form of Spanish, you know, whatever, you know, local dialect. Then you take it to somebody else who hasn't worked on that manuscript or that paper or whatever. Mm-hmm. That knows that particular dialect of Spanish and or that form of Spanish, and then you ask them to translate it from the Spanish back into English. Mm-hmm. And then you see what you get out of it. So what that tells me is that there's a processing that goes on. So one of the things that I would watch our students process things in their minds, because we had some students who were from tribal areas, or they were from areas where one of the major dialects wasn't common to them or wasn't native to them. I could almost see their minds transferring what they heard in English to the major dialect that they were used to, either Tagalog or Cebuano or Ilonggo or whatever it might be, then into their dialect, whatever it was. And then in order to respond or to write it out in English, then they had to kind of transfer it back to the major dialect and then into English the best they could. I don't know if this makes sense, but it's like I saw them doing all this processing of this information. And what I also began to realize is that it was actually helping them understand it. Mm-hmm. It was like a double process for them. So they were double thinking it. It's like they had to really think about, okay, how do I say that in this dialect? How is that going to sound in English? And then, okay, it says this in English, and they would have their Bible dictionaries and they would have their English. I think we use the NIV most of the time, and they would have their NIV Bible out there, and they would look at all this stuff, and you could just see the wheels turning. And there was a dramatic, I mean, absolutely dramatic change in the students going from first year to second year. They took that break, school break, and came back the second year. It was like their English skills had developed incredibly well. Just their how they carried themselves, how they processed things in class was like, I wondered if there was some kind of miraculous thing that had happened. And I'm convinced that it was this process of back and forth, of moving things back and forth from one language to another and having to think it through in order to understand it. Because you can't understand something in one language and transfer it to another language. Because there's so many culture, you know this, Jeff. I mean, mm-hmm. there's so yes. many cultural influences in the language. I'm convinced that that's what it was. And so all of that began to really play in. And then one day I got talked into going to an International Orality Network conference in Florida, in Orlando, Florida, which is near where we live, by some missionary friends of ours. And they says, yeah, come on. Well, you know, and I said, well, I can't really afford it. I'm not, you know, yeah, stay with us. We'll pay for it. So I went in there and I was like this kid in a candy store. I walked in And just the first session, everything fell into place. And I began to realize, this is what I'm learning to do. But I'd like stumbled into it. It wasn't like I'd set out to learn it. It was just, I run into this roadblock and I run into this challenge and I run into this situation, or I'd stumble over this little thing. And it all started just cascading and building. And finally, it just all locked into place. And it reminded me of the story I heard of Helen Keller being told about Jesus. And she was blind and she was deaf. And she says, oh, is that his name? It's like she had this relationship with God, but she didn't know that his name was Jesus.
Right.
And it was like that kind of a moment for me. It was just finally I had a container to put all these things that I'd been learning. And I saw where it all fit together, how it all fit together, why it fit together, and how it could even be more useful than what I was seeing it useful for.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those aha moments, you know?
Right, for sure.
Trip, we talk a lot about orality and one of the, as a process for teaching the gospel, but you're actually teaching students to be able to teach the gospel. Is that correct?
Exactly. Okay. Exactly right.
And so let me just kind of quiz you. I got a few questions that I have just coming from, you know, I didn't spend any time in the Philippines. And so just to set a little bit of a background, what is the difference between the way Filipino students, when their kids go to school, and the way Americans go to school? What's the format difference?
They are global, what are called global thinkers or holistic thinkers. They see the whole and they see the parts, but they only learn the parts within the whole. Whereas in Western thinking, we think linearly. In other words, we think in a line. And so it's a very different approach to thinking. So I might learn about plumbing by doing it, and then it's explained to me that I understand the whole process, and another person would be taught about plumbing and they would take in all the information, but they're not allowed to ask any questions in the classroom. And so they just take the information down, they memorize it, they learn it by rote. And they can speak it out, but they don't necessarily really understand all that they're doing. Now, here's a classic example that really happened in the Philippines. So we hired one of the young ladies that we were working with in another ministry that my wife and I had, Rainbow Village, and she had gone through a training for computers and how to be a secretary and that type of thing. And so I said, okay, great. You know, so I thought, well, let's give her a job, you know. So I brought her into our office at the Bible College Training Center that I was director of, and had her come in, and she looked at the computer for quite a while. And I said, so just go ahead and get going and just show me some things that you've learned. And she kind of just looked at me with a blank look, and she says, sir, how do you turn it on? And I went, whoa. It's like, I realized they hadn't taught her practical things. They'd just given her information. I don't know if that makes sense to you. That's very, very, very typical.
Well, it's kind of like when you're a kid in school and, you know, you just really learn what's on the test and you take the test and they grade right. you according to the test and say, now you're certified, but you've really never done any lab work.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. There's no lab work. There's no practical application. Right.
And one other question I have is, it sounds like, you know, for each student to, what was the acronym? Tell it in your own words.
IYOW.
And so how big was this class? And obviously some kids are, you know, they're more outgoing and have, but how big were your classes? And did everybody go through this process in the class?
Yes, everybody went through the process. So I required it because I began to realize how much it forced them into rethinking things and processing things. So the classes varied. I mean, we started off with 5 students the first year, and I'd have maybe half a dozen to a dozen. Some classes were 15, even upwards to 20. It really didn't matter the class size because it wasn't just the discussion part of it. They had to do that on paper as well. they had to keep a notebook of all that they were doing, studying, so that at the end of their 2 years, they had an inductive study notebook of 66 books of the Bible plus other subjects that we were doing. And a big component of that were these study questions where they had to answer in their own words. So it was rigorous. Yeah.
That's incredible.
We had, you know, just kind of make the point. We had students coming over from California, the California school, Murrieta. At first, they kind of complained. They says, well, we never had to work this hard before. But about a week or two into it, sometimes a few weeks, they would say, man, I am learning so much. Now, these are native English speakers. They're used to an American system of education. And so proof was in the pudding. I mean, we just saw this happen over and over and over again. A lot of the hit that I've seen, and I've done this in preaching. So, I wrote a book. The first part of it is me telling the story or the text in my own words, and then I go through and I walk through it expositionally. But the other thing is I've taught and I've preached in various churches and venues using this method. So I'll walk out and I'll say, hey, I want to tell you a story, and I start launching off into the story, and I said, I don't want you to look where it is, even if you think you know where it is. And so I just tell the story. And then I walk back through the story with them, and they can follow along in their Bibles. But what it does is it engages people at a much more experiential level rather than just kind of just reading it through. And one of the big knocks I would hear from pastors before they saw it, and when they see it take place, it's like, oh, okay. You know, they realize how effective it is. But one of the big knocks that I heard was, well, yeah, but that, you know, seeing like a kind of a sacredness in the way the scripture is written out and all of that sort of thing. And, you know, I thought about that and I said, well, what was the original form of the Bible? You know, what was the original form of the Gospels? It was all oral, all of it. And one simple place I can point people to is in the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus says, you've heard that it was said, and then he would quote the law that they were hearing over and over again. He says, but I tell you. In other words, he didn't assume that they could read it. He knew that they were oral learners and that they were hearing it, but they weren't reading it for themselves. And so that shows you, I mean, you know, that's, you know, the thing was, well, it's not, you know, it's not sacred or it's not really biblical. It's absolutely biblical. It's, if anything, it's putting it back into its original, how it originally came across.
The resources Tripp mentioned in this episode of Facilitating the Mission are available in the show notes for this podcast. Make sure you catch the next episode of Facilitating the Mission to hear the second half of this interview with Tripp Kimball.